Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Vodafone Business. With cybersecurity solutions from Vodafone, your business can hack off the hackers. See vodafone.ie/business.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome to Tech Talk. Coming up over the next hour, Dara Cassidy of bonkers.ie will join me with a guide to switching and saving when it comes to your mobile phone and broadband. We'll hear how AI is impacting the world of cybersecurity and take a sneak peek at the brand new Sky Glass. If you want to get in touch, you can do so right now. Drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. Now, you may have heard me mention this on News Talk Breakfast on Monday, but your TV, broadband and mobile phone bills are likely to go up in price again in April. Let's say you're spending around 60 quid a month on your phone bill alone. That tots up to 720 euro a year, but you could be paying as little as 180 euro a year. That's a saving of over 500 euro. How does it work? And is it painful to move? Dara Cassidy of bonkers.ie is with me now to guide us through it all. Dara, let's start at the very beginning. Can you just explain why prices are likely to go up again in April and how this has become the norm?
Sure. So around maybe 3 years ago or 4 years ago, a lot of the main broadband and TV providers started introducing these automatic or annual price adjustments, basically. So what they do is on the 1st of April, they increase the price of most of their broadband, TV and mobile plans by the rate of inflation for the year before, pretty much, plus an additional 3%. So if the CPI rate of inflation for last year, let's say, was 2%, it means that people's bills are going to go up by 5%. And we saw this last April when people saw their bills go up by around 7 or 8% and the April before. And now, as I said, this April, people are going to see their bills in most cases go up by around maybe 5% or a little bit more. And Three started doing it, and then they were quickly followed by Air and Vodafone. Some of the other suppliers haven't started doing it, but you could say for all intents and purposes they have. So for example, Sky officially in Ireland doesn't do this, but it has for the past 3 Aprils increased its prices by around between 4 to 5%. So they've all started copying each other. And look, I'm quite pragmatic, Jess. I know there is inflation and some of these networks really do need to invest in their network, and sometimes businesses need to increase their prices. That is fine per se, although obviously as a consumer advocate, I don't like to see prices go up, but it's the way they're doing it and communicating it that really bothers me, because to me it really is price signaling, which technically under consumer law is supposed to be illegal. So Air, Vodafone, Three are automatically telling the competition and themselves and the wider market every year, this is what we are going to do with our prices. And I just don't like the fact that they do it this way. And I would have thought that the CCPC, the consumer body, and the government would have stepped in, but they don't seem to care. So we are stuck with what we have. And one of the only ways to get around this is to switch to a better deal.
Can you just explain why it's a bad thing? Because I would have thought, and again, I'm not a consumer expert at all, but I would have thought it's kind of good to know what's coming down the track so you can take action. So what's your view, and why would you be in favour of this stopping?
It's because they are telling the markets and they are telling the competition what they are going to do, and then other people will copy them. So for example, when Three first came out and did it, it was no surprise then that Air and Vodafone in the space of around maybe 6 months also decided that they were going to do it. So when you tell your competitors and the competition what you were going to do, and you kind of give a bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, this is where prices are going, it is usually bad for consumers and it's bad for the market. Again, I understand that sometimes prices need to go up, but if you're flagging in advance what's going to happen, that's not good for consumers. Also, as well, they're increasing their prices by the rate of inflation plus 3%. I mean, Jess, if every company were to do that, we'd be in a huge, huge inflation loop, and inflation would spiral out of control. I mean, imagine Dunnes decided that every April they were going to increase the price of everything in their supermarkets by the rate of inflation plus 3%. And then Tesco decides to copy them. And then Lidl decides to copy them. And then suddenly in the space of about maybe 3 or 4 years, everyone's supermarket shop had gone up by about maybe 20 to 30% and more. I mean, there'd be absolute outrage, rightly so. So I don't like it. And also, people may remember around 6 or 7 years ago, I think it was the CEO of Bank of Ireland made a very, just a kind of a flippant, casual throwaway remark in a press release that he felt that interest rates and mortgage rates rather in Ireland weren't going to fall anymore. This was a few years ago when Ireland continually had among the highest mortgage rates in the Eurozone for various reasons. We don't have that quite so much. But he made kind of just a flippant throwaway remark that he just felt that mortgage rates in Ireland couldn't go any lower for various reasons. And he was rapped on the knuckles by the central bank because he was said that he had price signaled to the rest of the market, to AIB and to PTSB, that Bank of Ireland weren't going to change their rates. So that, you know, he was quite reprimanded publicly for it. And I thought that was good. So I'm just kind of unsure why in one sector of the market, so in mortgages, we're being so strong about this. And then in the broadband and TV sector, it seems to be a completely different rule. So I don't like it. And I said, if they want to increase their prices, do it, but do not flag every single year what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm. And if everybody is doing it now, does that mean that there's less value to be had if you do try and move provider, or are they still doing those incentive offers for new customers?
So good question. And ironically, actually, no. If anything, it's even better value to switch, because over the past 3 or 4 years, as I've said, we have seen these automatic annual price adjustments come in. So the rate of inflation plus 3%. And in some cases, if you're a customer with Air, Vodafone or Three, depending on when you signed up, you could have seen your bill for your broadband and TV go up by a cumulative 20% or more over the past 3 years. So the rate of increases for existing customers is quite high. But the deals for new customers, if anything, have actually gotten slightly lower. So there is really good value out there for broadband, for TV, for mobile in particular as well. A lot of the providers are now offering 500 megabit broadband as standard. So even if you're not necessarily saving money by switching, you're getting a better product. And again, when even your Virgin Media, which used to be one of the more expensive providers, has really, really good deals. And ironically, actually, Vodafone, who does do this automatic price hike each April, which I'm not a fan of, they've some really, really good deals. So if anything, Jess, it's even better to switch now, because as I said, for new customers, your plan is going to keep on going up and up every April. But the prices for, if you're an existing customer, but the prices for new customers aren't really changing. And if anything, they may be even creeping downward slightly.
So what are the factors that you need to take into consideration if you do want to shop around? So for example, we bought a house in August and we went to shop around just to see what the deals were in terms of providers for internet and TV. And we found that our options were quite limited in terms of who provided what in our area. So it's not a case of you hear of a great offer and all of a sudden you sign up. Certain things may not be available to you based on your air code, right?
No, exactly. And this is what people do, unfortunately, need to be aware of. Now, broadband, better broadband is gradually being rolled out throughout the country as a result of the national broadband plan. So people who maybe 2 or 3 years ago wouldn't have had many options might find that they have better options now. Ciro, which is another broadband provider, well, a wholesale provider, it's a joint venture between the ESB and Vodafone. It is continually rolling out fiber broadband, and also Virgin Media is continually investing in its network. But yes, somebody who is living in Cork or somebody who is living in Dublin may not have the same options. And there used to be a rural-urban divide, but sometimes now, because of the rollouts of the national broadband plan, you actually hear of people being in more rural areas who have slightly better broadband options than people who are in more urban areas. But what you can do is you can go onto a site like bonkers.ie, you can put in your address or air code and we will tell you all of the options that are available to you. Because unfortunately, yes, not everybody is going to have the same amount of options. And if you're in a certain area, you may be very, very lucky. Where I am, I live in Dunleary in Side County Dublin, and I am in like a black spot. I have Virgin Media and that is pretty much all I have. Now I'm kind of a unique example because you just go across the road and somebody would have better options. But yes, I mean, all these deals that you see on TV aren't necessarily going to be available to you, unfortunately. But most people now should at least have fiber to the cabinet broadband, which allows you to get speeds up to about 100 megabits per second. But if you have full fiber into the home, then most providers now at a minimum are offering 500 megabit broadband and often as cheap as maybe 30 to 35 euro a month the first year.
So that is really good to know in terms of your broadband and shopping around and so on. How important is the customer service and the anecdotal reports that you might hear about some of the providers? Has there been strides made in terms of creating a bit of uniformity when it comes to customer service and also teething problems when you move from one provider to another? Because a colleague of mine was telling me that she moved from one provider to another provider and she had a bit of an issue getting through to the new provider to communicate with the old provider to ensure that her account was fully transported across.
So customer service can still be an issue. It has gotten better, particularly during COVID. It was quite poor. Your listeners will probably remember the bad rap and the bad reputation that Air had. In fairness to the providers, they have gotten a little bit better. But broadband, just by its nature, because sometimes you are changing boxes or maybe something needs to be installed, it is by its nature a little bit more of a finicky bill to switch. I'd still encourage people to do it at least every few years, not even just to save money, but just actually to see what's out there. And maybe a new box has been released. Maybe there's a new, service. It's not always just about saving money. A tip I kind of have though, Jess, is sometimes I do recommend, and it does mean you might pay a little bit more for 1 month, is people often, they'll cancel their broadband and TV maybe immediately. And, you know, you usually give 30 days notice. And then they'll sign up to the new TV provider or broadband provider. I think it's usually a good idea to make sure that your new broadband and TV is up and running, is connected, is working. Everyone in the family is happy. And then cancel your existing service. Now, it does mean that maybe for, you know, a month you might be overpaying a little bit or double paying, but it does mean that you're not going to be left without any type of service, because if you do have teething problems with your new provider, you can absolutely say to them, I am not beginning to pay this bill until I am up and running. So in that case, you're not going to be double charged or overpay. But it does really, really help in situations where maybe there are a few teething problems and you can still rely on the old service that you had. I had that a few years ago. For example, I switched from Virgin Media to Air, I think it was, or maybe vice versa. And there was a few teething problems, but luckily I hadn't fully cancelled the Air package. So I was still able to use my broadband while I got things sorted out with Virgin Media. So that's something that I would, just advise people.
Okay. Let's talk briefly about mobile plans. We've spoken numerous times about the value that's out there at the moment. I was doing a bit of a sniff around this morning just to see what value is out there in traditional mobile networks versus the digital mobile networks. And some of the SIM-only plans from the traditional networks work out at around 360 quid. That's obviously SIM-only, so you're not getting your phone, your upgrade and all the rest, versus 180 quid for a digital mobile network plan like GOMO. That's obviously a significant difference. Why are people still opting for those traditional mobile network plans? Is it a lack of trust, a lack of awareness? What do you think it is?
I think it's a lack of awareness. I mean, some people, obviously, you're very aware of things like this. You're very tech savvy. I'm all about saving money. But the day-to-day person sometimes isn't. And I'm always amazed when I talk to people about SIM-only plans and SIM-only deals. A lot of people still aren't aware of what they are or how they work. And I think sometimes it is maybe just inertia and just a lack of knowledge. But there is just excellent value with some of these at the moment. And there are so many people who continue to pay maybe 60, 70 euro or maybe even more for their mobile each month, even though they have the phone paid off, and they could move to a service like Sky Mobile, for example, for 15 euro a month, or Clear Mobile, where it's only 12.99 a month in some cases. So I'd really, really encourage people to do it. And with some of these SIM-only deals, now obviously, as you've said, it's SIM-only, so you're not going to get a phone, and you do need to make sure that the phone that you do have is unlocked and can therefore take another operator's SIM. But if your phone has been paid off, that's usually fairly simple to do, but it can take a few days, so just be warned. But these deals are great. And with deals like GOMO, for example, now most listeners will probably be familiar with GOMO. It's $14.99 a month. It's a subsidiary of Air. GOMO was charging $14.99 a month for life, okay? So if you, though, were with its subsidiary Air, you could be charged maybe 50 or 60 euro a month. And then also on top of that, it's going to increase every April by the rate of inflation plus 3%. So it's kind of mad. So I'd really encourage people to check out the SIM-only deals, and also Clear Mobile, which is the kind of the low-cost option from Vodafone. It's now offering 5G on its server. So it used to cap your speed at 5 megabits per second, which wouldn't be very, very good. Now it says it's offering 5G, which will give you a much better speed. So that's another option for people to look at. So look, I'm a huge fan of SIM-only deals. Couldn't talk about them enough. Like I said, just make sure that your phone is unlocked. And of course, you don't need to get a new number. If you change from one network to another, you can keep your number.
Mm. My final question is, for people who may be intimidated by the notion of haggling with their existing provider or still have that grow for a bit of brand loyalty, do brands offer deals if you try to haggle, or is your best bet just to move, even if it's for 12 months, and then go back?
They can't. I guess it depends on the options that are available to you. So like you were saying, Jess, your options are kind of limited where you are. So, you know, you might threaten to move and then they might say goodbye. And then it's like, oh, dear, I don't really have anyone good to move to. And I'm kind of in a similar situation. But I would say, I mean, you, and this is the same for most products and services. And it's the same for energy and gas and electricity. Usually the best deals are available to people who switch. You can haggle, but usually you're not going to get the same good customer discounts as someone who actually moves. But in some cases, you may not want to switch. So maybe, you know, with broadband, as I've said, it can be sometimes a bit more of a finicky bill or utility to switch, and maybe you don't want to do it every year. And in that case, absolutely, the providers are open. Sky in particular tends to be quite good. I mean, there's even memes and jokes online about everyone having their annual conversation with Sky, and they all pretend that they can't pay the bill, and Sky knocks off 20 or 30 euro. It's similar with Virgin Media as well. I've haggled with them and I find them quite good. Just make sure that you're talking to the right person, okay? So usually you need to be talking to what's called either the retention team or the loyalty team. And that's so important as well, even when it comes to making complaints and things like that. You always need to make sure that you're just talking to the right person. So if you do ring up and you say, look, I'm just struggling with my bill, you can pretend you're struggling. Is there anything that you can do? And can you put me in touch with the right department so that I could talk about what I'm paying each month and then take it from there?
Brilliant stuff. There are top tips as always. You can visit bonkers.ie for more. Dara Cassidy, as always, thanks so much for joining me here on News Talk.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it is definitely a worthwhile exercise. I would love to hear from you. Have you made the move and saved some cash? Or maybe you're still in the shop around phase. Drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, when we come back here on News Talk, we'll hear how AI is impacting cybersecurity.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Now, I'm sure you're blue in the face when it comes to hearing conversations about AI, but one area in which it has the potential to be massively disruptive is cybersecurity. On March 11th, Zero Day Con will take place in the Convention Centre in Dublin, and one of the speakers, Ronan Murphy of Smart Tech 247, is with me now. Ronan, I always love chatting with you, so thanks a million for your time. It's been a while since you've been on. And I'm curious to know if you're seeing some of the challenges that AI pose when it comes to cybersecurity, because there's been an awful lot of talk about it, you know, certain hot takes and obviously conversations online. So does that correlate with what you're seeing on the ground?
Hi, Jess, and thank you for having me on. Yes, look, absolutely. Artificial intelligence is really creating a lot of uncertainty when you look at the cyber threat landscape. And I would say that AI is a double-edged sword insofar as it is very good for organizations to use new and sophisticated tools that help them to take an offensive stance in terms of protecting their employees and their business and their data. But also on the other edge of that sword, you have the cyber criminals who are successfully leveraging AI to automate the types of attacks that they're deploying. For example, I'm sure, Jess, you've seen the emails coming in and they're becoming far more sophisticated, and it's difficult to actually tell if they're real or fake. It's no longer a Nigerian prince who's promising you a treasure trove of gold if you send them your information. So they've become far more sophisticated. The language and the rhetoric in these types of phishing attacks, whether it's on text message or on email or on social media communication, they are far better and they're far harder to decipher if it's malicious or not. You're also seeing then the ability to create the bad guys to create malware and malicious software. You're seeing that they have an ability to exploit vulnerabilities in systems and use AI to understand how they can scan systems faster, identify weak points and expose any gaps. And then obviously the big one, the one that everyone is talking about, and it was a big talking point in the recent AI event in Paris with all of the world leaders, is deepfakes and the ability to generate synthetic media. And that can be used for fraud, it can be used for disinformation, it can be used for social engineering. And as we saw in Paris this week, how it can impersonate even world leaders like Macron, where deepfakes were used to put his face on various different characters for the event. So while widespread AI attacks are emerging, they're improving, I think what we're really seeing is the ability for adversarial AI to be operationalized at scale by typically people who are not that technically proficient, which is the scary part.
And this is something that, you know, you and I have spoken about before, how technology and not just AI, but I mean, parts of the dark web are enabling the non-professional scammers or the cyber attackers to dip their toe in the water and create even more havoc because they don't know what they're doing. And there can be collateral damage that nobody anticipated. I guess I'm wondering, as the threats evolve with AI, are the tools and the detection tools benefiting from AI as well? Like, are teams now deploying AI solutions to try and catch and kill every element of this?
Yeah, absolutely. But you made a very important observation just now, Jess. And that is, in days gone by, when you and I would discuss the emerging threat landscape, you quite rightly indicated that in order to find the commoditized type cyber software or the malicious software that you could use, you would have to go to the dark web, right? The difference now is you don't even need to go to the dark web any longer. You don't need to download Tor and go into the cold underbelly of the internet. You now have it readily available with large language models and open source models that are readily available all over the globe. And depending on how sophisticated the threat actors are in their ability to prompt these models to help them build their campaign, their phishing campaign, their malicious software campaign, if this is readily available at your fingertips, on your mobile devices, on your laptops. So that's one of the huge changes. But now, to answer your question, indeed, we're seeing a huge adoption by the industry to build tooling and technology to fight this off. One of my companies, Get Visibility, is an AI company that has built incredible artificial intelligence capabilities to help organizations understand their data and protect their data and to really adopt AI defensively. So I would say yes, in companies like Smarttech 247 and Get Visibility and a lot of the global leaders, AI is really allowing them to become more proficient in how they're using this to fight, to stave off the threat and to fight the bad guys.
I do wonder about the responsibility of the creators of these large language models when it comes to catching and detecting those who might be using it for nefarious purposes. I mean, obviously, it's a difficult thing to do from an encryption point of view and a data protection point of view and a whole host of points of view. But should there be some sort of safeguards ingrained in those models, or is that even possible?
I honestly don't think that's possible. I mean, I serve on the Irish government's AI Advisory Council, and the regulation or the guardrails that you apply to AI have to be approached with a very high degree of caution. And the reason I say that is that I am not against regulation of AI, but I think you have to be extremely careful of how you use it and how who determines what type of regulation is in place. For example, my perspective is that you should not regulate the building or the architecting of AI, but you should definitely consider the regulation of the adoption of AI in specific scenarios, for example, facial recognition technologies and so forth. If you try and over-regulate AI with the pace that it's moving, you will definitely kill your ability to innovate quickly enough to keep pace. And one of the things we've seen this week in Paris is that the US and the Vice President, J.D. Vance, have taken the view that Europe is overregulated, they're killing innovation, they're falling behind, and both the US and China are driving ahead, building innovation, building AI, investing heavily in it. And I believe that's a balancing act. And you, I guess you have to ask the question, do you want to, even with the risks associated with it, do you want to let a bunch of bureaucrats in Brussels determine how AI is built? Or do you want to look at it from a governmental level and determine what type of regulation you're going to have in the applicability of that AI? They're very, very different. And there's probably a whole separate podcast with yourself, Jess, discussing the nuances and the intricacies of that concept.
One thing that I've been thinking about in recent weeks in the context of what's going on politically around the world is that, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, for example, and this is a small example, but in one of his videos, he mentioned that they're now going to allow news content back onto their platforms because they'd kind of put the kibosh on that because they didn't think people wanted to see it. And that to me, and I don't think I'm a stupid person, but that to me kind of reminded me that with a flick of a switch almost, they can alter what we see. And that content then appears on platforms. That is an incredible power for them to have. And given the political landscape that we're in at the moment, it's pretty scary for that level and that type of decision to be left with big tech. Therefore, I do wonder if the average citizen needs to have a good understanding of how regulation and legislation is in place to protect us where possible.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very thorny subject. I mean, for example, if I were to take someone like you, Jess, who's very well informed, very technically savvy, and I would imagine someone who is able to distill down the truth from your own independent view of both sides of the coin, right? Maybe not everyone has that same intellect, right? That's debatable. But who is to say that somebody sitting in California has the ability to control what you see or you don't see? The problem you have is that it is impossible to eliminate bias from AI or from content moderation, because people naturally will have a bias. And you could argue that the bias in Facebook. Not argue, this is factually correct, actually, that the bias in Facebook and Google and so forth had moved to the extreme left. Right? Some people might say that's a good thing. Some people, obviously, like the MAGA movement in the US, will say that's a bad thing. But I would be of the view personally that it's not good being too far to the left. It's not good being too far to the right. And even to try and get it in the middle, it means that you need to try and eliminate bias from the moderation of this content, which is incredibly difficult to do. So therefore, I guess the argument from a lot of people, and myself included in that, would be that if the content isn't illegal, such as, you know, child porn or something else, it's automatically moderated and banned and blocked. But the content that is then shared, it should be like what X has done under Elon Musk, and I think now what Facebook are doing. You need to allow a capability like community notes to help validate the truth or fiction associated with content that is in relation to a perspective. And I feel personally that allocating that to somebody sitting in either Texas, who's right wing, or in California, who's left wing, you cannot win. I just don't see a way that that bias can be overcome. So again, a very different topic, and a topic I'm sure we could spend hours debating and discussing, but it is an area I've put a lot of thought into.
And I hope this is something that we do come back to a later stage, because I've been thinking about it for quite a bit, as I said. And although you're dealing with sort of the dark underbelly of the very serious cyber threats, I wonder to a certain extent about the security concerns from that come from the information that people see online. They may not take action, you know, in relation to it online, but they can take what they see online and then take action on the streets. I think it's something that we will have to come back to at some stage, because...
So the question I have for you on that, right, is the content that the people are consuming online, is it a perspective, or is it content which is factually incorrect or a lie or illegal? And that's where the lines get blurred. People have a perspective, but someone else may have a different perspective. And what we've seen in the US particularly is that perspective started to get hardwired into the content moderation, which obviously has pushed a very large section of the population in North America to the hard right. And that is where you get into very murky territory, is when you decide who should be the overseers of that moderation. And it feels to me personally that if it's not illegal, if it's a perspective, then perhaps it should be the consumers of that content themselves who moderate through community notes the controls that go around that.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And I guess the final thing I'd say on it is that I suppose I've just been watching, and everyone's been watching over the last number of years, that a fact no longer means a fact, because there are certain outlets with massive audience that can portray something as a fact. They can take an opinion or an interpretation and splash it on a ticker bar at the bottom of a screen, and all of a sudden, that's the story to a certain cohort of people. And, you know, as you said, you know, not everybody is digitally savvy, not everyone is media literate, as perhaps they would like to be. So they don't have the capacity or the time or the interest to go and do their own digging and to ask, well, hang on a second, what source is this from? And is it backed up? Is opinion being portrayed as fact? And that for me is the scary side of things, particularly when, you know, the likes of AI are starting to publish news articles where, yes, sources are sometimes being cited, which is great, but sometimes the source being cited is actually from an outlet where they don't deal in facts, they deal in their interpretation of facts, if you get me.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think what you're starting to see is that when... So if we take a step back for a moment, right? We had And this was mentioned by the vice president at the event, J.D. Vance, at the event in Paris yesterday. The whole moderation of content had gone so far to the left that when you asked Google Gemini to paint you a picture of the founding fathers of the US, I mean, it gave you an image of George Washington and he was black, for example, and the Pope was black. So it had gone to the extreme left, right? And that obviously is not factually correct either. But the moderators of that content or the guys building the model, their view was very much that, you know, this is the way we should rewrite history, which isn't factually correct either. And that represents a huge challenge. And the exact same goes for the, you know, the hard right guys, because they'll try and rewrite history as well. And therefore, my key point is that it is technically impossible to eliminate bias from the overseers of these tools, because they're created by humans, and irrespective of human beings have a bias, and that bias will always lean in a particular direction. Obviously, if you could get people that are centrist and could give balanced bias all of the time, then that's ideal. But truthfully, that's not realistic. And therefore, I think generally, from my perspective, probably the most technically astute way of doing this and is when someone has access to a very large consumer audience, like you said, and if they propagate information which is not factually correct, then there is the ability, once you hit a certain volume, that people like you or who are highly respected in the media have the ability to contribute a community note, which will say, well, this is factually incorrect. Now, if it's a perspective, it's a perspective. But if it is a factually incorrect statement, you have the ability to correct that and it gets tagged as being factually incorrect. But you are right. I agree with you. Misinformation and the ability for people to go down rabbit holes and to roll up their sleeves and do the due diligence that's required on misinformation. It's a huge risk. It's a huge problem. But it is not easily solved. And I don't believe that moderation is that simple to implement, because moderators, who are they? What's their view? It's a difficult one. It's a difficult one to operationalize, I would say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, look, we know that Zero Day Con is taking place, as I said, on March 11th. It's been running for a few years now, and I'm just interested to know, have the topics and the meaty talks changed in nature in recent years as businesses and consumers become more aware of cyber threats? Or is it still the sort of basic principles, the same basic principles that we had at the beginning?
No, it's changed. Oh, my goodness. And it's changed so much in the last 12 months, even. Given the rise of an availability of generative AI, the ability, as we discussed in the opening discussion, the ability to operationalize AI to build attacks, to bypass traditional security, to really disrupt businesses with using this technology has become a huge, huge challenge. And then it's not even that, it's the complexity of data and misinformation, like we've discussed. Which data do you want to use to drive operational efficiency in your business by using AI? What does the regulation mean, such as the EU AI Act? All of these now have suddenly become front of mind for organizations, both from a defensive perspective, from an efficiency perspective, from a complexity perspective. You're seeing whole new roles being created within businesses, trying to understand how do they deal with this double-edged sword, both from a benefit perspective, but also from a risk perspective. You're seeing an absolute change in this industry like I've never seen in 20 years. It's fascinating to observe it from the front lines.
Great stuff. Look, I've seen the lineup and there are fantastic speakers who will be in the Convention Centre in Dublin on March 11th. If you want more information or indeed to get tickets, you can head on over to zerodaycon.com. Ronan, I could talk to you for hours, but unfortunately we're up against the clock. Thanks so much for your time and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks a million.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Now, earlier in the week, on the 11th, we had Safer Internet Day. There was a whole host of brilliant talks right around the country addressing some of the concerns relating to safety of our young people online. There was, of course, as always, the brilliant CyberSafe Kids survey, which I'll talk about in just a quick second. But the Online Safety Commissioner, Niamh Hodnett, joined Pat Kenny to talk about some of the initiatives and action that her office is delivering.
We've further specified those parental controls obligations so that from July, the platforms who offer their services to those who are under the age of 16 have to put in place time limits so that parents can put in place time limits for the amount of time their child spends on the platform. And they also have to restrict the content and be able to restrict the content that their child can see or who can see their child's content. That's to address the concern about grooming. So those measures come into place from July, and parental controls have to be easy to use and easy to find. And again, because I know how difficult it can be for parents to stay on top of all these things when their children are on a number of apps, we have a lot of helpful information on our website, as to how to go about parental controls, or if you see something online you're concerned about or your child's concerned about, how to go about reporting that. And we also have a contact centre if a parent or a child would want to contact us to get further information in this regard as well.
Yeah, that was Online Safety Commissioner Niamh Hodnett speaking to Pat Kenny on Tuesday. You can listen back to that interview in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what that office does over the next wee while, as we've been talking about on this programme today and in recent months. There's been a dramatic shift in attitude from the big tech companies, or the very large online platforms, as they're called, under the remit of the Online Safety Commissioner. And I suppose compliance with regulation and legislation is going to be important, not only to keep young people safe online, but to keep everyone safe online as well. As we were talking about with Rona Murphy earlier in the show, you know, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation that circulates and can be damaging. And I think one of the many challenges facing any regulatory body looking to put manners on the internet is, how do you quantify the potential damage that can be done? Because you and I could read the same thing and we could walk away with entirely different interpretations, understandings, feelings from what we have read. Obviously we will keep an eye on how that unfolds and when the action from the Online Safety Commissioner really does take impact, and hopefully it won't be too long before we see it. I mentioned there a second ago the research conducted by CyberSafe Kids. They always have fantastic data. They're going out and speaking to young people. So the survey that they released on Tuesday found that 82% of young children, so that's 8 to 12 year olds, are allowed to use phones and other smart devices unsupervised in their bedrooms. They carried out the survey of 2,000 primary school children. And, you know, of those 2,000 children, 32% said that they had either been bothered or upset by something they've experienced online in the last year, and only half spoke to a parent or trusted adult. And I think this gets to the crux of everything, right? So unsupervised access, I can understand from a parent's point of view how, why, and when it might happen, but it can't be the norm. Also, establishing that relationship with a young person, it doesn't have to be a parent, it can be a trusted adult, whereby if they see something, if they come across something, if someone says something to them online, that they have a place to turn and they have someone to talk to, so that they're not trying to process it on their own. We know the kids they don't have the capability to do that, and that's not their fault. That's where we have to come in. And I know that a lot of parents can feel powerless when it comes to this topic. There are brilliant resources out there. So CyberSafe Kids is one. The ISPCC Parental Hub is another. Webwise.ie is fantastic too. Vodafone have a brilliant booklet that you can get online that initiates and kind of guides the parents through conversations to initiate with their child, but also a bit of a guide to what the different apps are, how they work, how to block report and all the rest. So just please do take the time to reach out and ask for help if you need help. Get onto those organizations. Email me, techtalk@newstalk.com. I'm always eager to try and help where I can. But look, as we know, that this issue isn't going away. So hopefully we can do bits and pieces to, I suppose, help until a proper solution is rolled out. Right, we have just enough time for a few quick questions. First one this week is from Patricia, who says, "Hi, for my daughter's confirmation, we gave her limited access to my old reconfigured iPhone 6, setting her up in iCloud, including her on family iCloud protection features, etc., on our own phones." Excellent. "The issue is her friends are all understandably on WhatsApp. When we try to download WhatsApp, it says it needs iOS 15.1, where we can't upload anything more than iOS 12 on her iPhone 6. We managed to get WhatsApp in her name in our family iPad, which isn't ideal. Any advice is welcome on overcoming this tech issue or introducing 12-year-olds to phones." Well, look, I'm going to stay on this topic of child safety and navigating parenting in the digital world. This is one of my missions for 2025. So please trust that I will be back with more information and support for you as parents. In relation to the question on the WhatsApp, unfortunately, you do need to have that a newer version of iOS, which is unsupported now on iPhone 6s. The only thing that you could do, as you have done, is put it on an iPad or give access through a browser. So you could use WhatsApp Web on a computer. But unfortunately, there's not much else that you can do. The alternative is to see and consider getting a newer phone. So you could look to trade in the iPhone 6 and then get a more recent model. So you could go down the route of, and I see here about the iCloud, the family iCloud. So obviously you want to stick with Apple, but you could go down the route of a refurbished phone. So anything, if you get an iPhone X, the iPhone 10 or the 11, they are very, they're not that expensive, relatively speaking. And you could get a refurbished one that would have app support, iOS support for the next wee while, that would enable your child to have access to WhatsApp. So unfortunately, I don't have a magic wand for you, but I do hope that helps. And you can drop me an email as well if you want, if you have any more questions. Next, we have, sticking with refurbished phones, Sean says, "Hi Jess, my wife is thinking of using Swappy.ie. I'm not sure if you've mentioned them before. Any advice?" Yes, Sean, Swappy.ie, my brother bought his phone from Swappy.ie and had a great experience with them. What I would say is just make sure you're navigating or your wife is navigating the website with eyes wide open. So you want to make sure that you are looking at the condition of the phone. So I think they rank them by excellent, very good, good, whatever. It will come with a year warranty when you buy from Swappy.ie. So if there are any problems, check that out. You can go back to them. Also check out the amount of storage. So make sure that she opts for the storage that is sufficient for her wants and needs. Alternatives to Swappy would be mintplus.ie, which is an Irish business. I think they're based in Leopardstown. Then there is also refurbed.ie. So there's a few different options for you. Next up, and the final one for this week is Connor. And Connor sends a lovely email, so thank you very much for that bit. But then he says, "I'm thinking of switching to GoMo Mobile because of their pricing. I'm self-employed, but use my phone for data rather than calls, typically emails, Teams, especially when I'm away from my home office in Limerick City. You sounded really positive last week on Pat Kenny, but I'm looking at online reviews and they're not great, but I'm inclined to believe they're not accurate, mainly only people with perceived poor experiences posting reviews." Yeah, Connor, I would say that. Now look, there was definitely an issue with GoMo when it set up a number of years ago in terms of porting people across. A lot of people signed up for the introductory offer and it meant that there were delays with people moving from their old network to GoMo. That, I would imagine, accounts for a significant portion of the negative reviews. Both my parents are on GOMO. A lot of my friends and family are now on GOMO, and they've had excellent experiences. I've used it in the past. I had a second SIM, and I can't speak highly enough about it. The coverage is the same coverage. It uses the air network. So where there's air coverage, you'll get GOMO coverage. It's excellent value. It's very easy to set up, to navigate, and all the rest. You sign up online, then you follow the steps to port your number across, and that's it. And you're paying 15 quid. And as Dara Cassidy said earlier in the show, it's very hard to argue against that when you are looking at the amount of money that traditional phone contracts cost. So I would definitely recommend it. That is it, I think, for now. If you have any other questions, drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. I am off Monday and Tuesday, but I will be back with Kieran Cudahy on Wednesday's Hard Shoulder. So enjoy your weekend, and I will chat to you next week.